Hi, this is Peter Asher.
And this is Jeremy Clyde.
And you are listening to the Follow Your Dream podcast
with Robert Miller.
Everyone has a dream. Robert Miller is a musician who had a dream to become a rock star. He followed his dream and he succeeded. If you're ready to pursue and succeed at your dream, then listen up and get inspired and motivated to take action today. Welcome to the Follow Your Dream podcast.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Follow Your Dream podcast with listeners in 200 countries. I'm Robert Miller, your host. I am honored today to have as my guest Rod Argent of the Zombies, one of the greatest bands of the British invasion era of the 1960s. They had massive hits with She's Not There and Tell Her No, and later with Time of the Season, all written by Rod. And they had a sound and a sophistication that was unlike any other band at that time, mainly due, in my opinion, to Rod's outstanding keyboard work. And a whole lot of people must agree with me, because the Zombies were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2019. After the Zombies disbanded, Rod formed Argent, and he had another massive hit with Hold Your Head Up, on which he played an iconic Hammond organ solo. He went on to play with The Who, Andrew Lloyd Webber, and Ringo, among others. And he also recorded a classical music album. And he and his longtime partner, Colin Blunstone, have a new Zombies album coming out soon, called Different Game. We're going to play a couple of cuts from that album. He is truly a man for all seasons. And as you know, in the middle of this episode, as I do with all my musical guests, Rod and I are going to do what I call a song fest. We're going to play a bit of his greatest hits. We're going to talk about them. You'll get the backstories. And nobody else does this in podcasts. And you also know that in every episode of this podcast, I like to feature one of my songs underneath the introduction and at the end. And I always try to make that song relevant somehow to my guest. And in this instance, I've chosen the song Waiting for Me from my new album, Bobby M and the Paisley Parade, that just came out recently. And I chose this song because it's got a real 60s vibe led by the keyboards, just like Rod has led his bands on the keys. So, Rod Argent, welcome to the Follow Your Dream podcast, baby.
Oh, bless you, Robert. That's fantastic. Thank you.
Well, it's fantastic to have you on the show. You know, I came of age musically in the 60s when the Zombies were and all the British invasion bands were out there in force. And then I segued into the whole jazz rock era of the 70s. And to me, you and the Zombies were a bridge between those two eras. Would you agree?
Well, I guess in a way we probably were, and it wasn't conscious. I mean, the thing was that I grew up loving classical music until I got turned onto rock and roll when I was 11 years old by hearing Elvis sing Hound Dog. And for me, that was a way of, first of all, hearing black music by proxy, because I'd never heard any rhythm and blues or any really black artists. But it led me to play records by, well, first of all, Big Mama Thornton, because that was her original Hound Dog, but then Ray Charles very quickly. And I love Ray's playing. But I was, at that time, even though I was still loving Elvis Presley, I was absolutely in love from the age of about 14 with the early Miles Davis group, with Coltrane and Cannonball Adderley and Red Garland and later Bill Evans, which I just absolutely loved. And the first record that I could afford to buy by Miles was Milestones. It was an EP. And I didn't realize that that was his first foray into modal music. I had absolutely no idea. But I never thought of introducing any of that into what I thought we were, a simple rock and roll band. But it was just there. And I was still listening to classical music and stuff as well. In the early TV coverage in the States, of She's Not There, when it came to the piano solo, they didn't understand that at all. I mean, rock and roll was guitar groups, And when it got to a piano solo, they just showed the drums, you know, so the camera went completely off me.
I have to tell you, when you started out with that little introduction to She's Not There, the bass and the keys.
Yeah.
I mean, it just set the tone for the song. And you're right. The solo was so different for that era. As I said in my introduction, it was so much more sophisticated than so much of the rock and roll that was being played at that time. It was so different, and I congratulate you for it. It was spectacular.
Well, being fairly selfish, I always used to, when we did all our live stuff, I always used to improvise a lot. And I would always put, in anything that I wrote, I would have a piano solo, you know. And the thing was, it was genuine improvisation. I mean, if you hear some of the early outtakes of She's Not There, you'll hear the solo is completely different on each one. So it wasn't a constructed solo. It was just improvised. And that was because I was listening to so much jazz at the time and I just loved it. But at the same time, I still love the early raw rock and roll of Elvis. And of course, when the Beatles started 2 years before America in 62 in the UK, like everybody else there, I was completely blown away with the sort of honesty of their playing, etc. And I loved that too. So I was a complete conglomeration of things, even though I thought we were just, in a way, being the Beatles sort of thing. But I didn't realise until later when I remember, I think the Byrds were the first people that I read who said Rod Argent's solo in She's Not There really formed our way of playing 8 Miles High. He said, because, you know, with all those sort of jazz improvisation things. And I thought, I couldn't hear that at all between the two of us. But he said it, and other people have said it since. So I'm very, very grateful. But it was a natural thing.
You know, what you're describing, though, is exactly the way that musicians should evolve, because you had different influences and you melded those influences into what became your playing. Now, I was going to ask you a question. When you said on She's Not There, you didn't have a constructed solo. And so many of the solos back in the 60s, they were constructed. You know, when George Harrison did a solo, every time they played that song in concert, he'd repeat that solo. And he did marvelous solos. But I'm interested, when you guys played Around the World, when you played She's Not There, did you play the same solo or did you do an improvisation?
It was in those days, it was always just an improvisation because, I mean, there was no, I didn't have the patience to go and analyze it note for note and to replay it. But it's very interesting because having played things for so many years, in the end, they become the sort of same construction. But I always try and do something a little bit different because we've got a band that really listens to each other. And if I go somewhere slightly different, they're with me immediately. And that's so lovely. And that's another link with, you know, the great jazz groups, because that's what everyone does. They listen and they sympathize and they bounce off each other. So that's very important, I think.
Now, when you recorded back in the 60s, I'm assuming that you guys were all in the studio essentially playing live together. Am I right?
Yeah.
Because that's changed, of course. Over time, you know, people record and they do note by note and instrument by instrument. I always felt, and with my group, this is what I do. You put a band that's well rehearsed in a studio and you get that live sound, that interaction that you're talking about, which makes the whole thing work.
I really feel that. And it really came home to me. I've done lots of record production and I've had some big successes with other artists producing records. And I've done everything that you've said. I've done things remotely. I've done the thing where you lay one track and then the next and then the next and use the whole of studio technology. I felt the band had never been playing so well up until the point we got the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction. And we really wanted to repeat that experience in the studio.
I have to ask you a question about back then. I've asked all the guys that were part of the British invasion more or less the same question. What was it like back then? Did you have the whole screaming girls thing going on? And tell me what your impressions are now. It's 50 plus years later.
It was quite extraordinary at the beginning. I mean, we were 18 years old. And I think probably that was, no, we were just 19 when we first came to America and played on the Murray the K Brooklyn Fox show.
I think I saw you in that show. Okay.
No.
Who else was? Well, I went to see a Murray the K show. Now, it wasn't in the Brooklyn Fox. It was in New York. It was in a New York City, a Manhattan theater. But he had those shows, and he had like a great lineup in these shows.
Oh,
and I remember
God.
The show that I saw, the two acts at the bottom of the bill were The Who and The Cream. That's
the
cream. Way they were built.
Wonderful.
So you were on one of those shows, huh?
Yeah. We were on the 1964 show. And we were just coming off a number one record. We were scared stiff. We were five skinny young white boys who came in, and we thought that we were just copying Black Rhythm and Blues or whatever, you know, whatever we were copying. And we thought, and we realized that we were playing with some of our heroes, and we were playing with Benny King and the Drifters. We were playing with Patti LaBelle. In fact, we were on, when we did the sound check, we immediately followed Patti LaBelle. And I was scared silly because I thought they're going to hate us and they're going to completely shun us. But the opposite was true. But then, as you said, you know, like 19 years old, you go to America, you're doing what is a dream, because you know, with your first song, pretty much, it was the second song I ever wrote. We had a number one record in the States. And I remember just 8 years before hearing Elvis in, I think it was 8 years before anyway. I've probably got that completely wrong. But singing Hound Dog and being so knocked out, thinking, I was 11, thinking I've got to be part of this in some way or other, but there's no way anybody English can come anywhere near what they're doing. We only just barely understand what we're listening to, you know. And then just 8 years later, I found out at that time, and I didn't realize this until the 90s, when I was speaking to an Elvis freak who was a DJ in Ireland. He said, "I can't believe you didn't know that Elvis had three of your songs on his jukebox." And I thought, no, what ridiculous turnaround. But apart from that, as you say, it's a dream, because all that you didn't have to try. All the young girls, all the beautiful young girls wanted to know you. You know, it was a late teenage dream. I mean, a complete dream.
I've spoken about this with other guys that were part of that whole British invasion thing. And the irony is that you took American music that was overlooked. The blues were basically an overlooked genre in America. You brought it back to England, you redid it, and you gave it back to the US, and it worked in that context.
And do you know who was largely responsible, I believe, rather than the Rolling Stones? I believe it was the Beatles right at the beginning, because they opened the whole scene for people in the UK to react to, and particularly with Motown and the black artists that were in Motown at the time, because they came from Liverpool, which was a port, and all the merchant seamen used to sail into New York, and they would listen to all the jazz, that the wonderful jazz that was still going on there. I mean, seminal people with nobody in the clubs by that time. I remember seeing the Rolling Stones just before we turned professional. And I remember, and it was just before their first record came out, Come On, the Chuck Berry record. And I remember us all being in this little club that it held 50 people, and they were all sitting down on stools. Jagger wasn't moving around at all. He was sitting on a stool. They were doing real purist, in their eyes, not so much Muddy Waters, but mostly Chuck Berry. But yeah, but all blues things. And they sounded fabulous. In fact, that's the best I ever heard them in my memory anyway.
Got off the stool eventually, I'll tell you that.
Yeah. But it was just brilliant. And I think the Beatles were responsible for opening the scene to that.
Yes.
And then, of course, in the States, you tended, with a few exceptions, of having very categorized radio stations. So you had race stations, you know, and the white kids, generally speaking, would only listen to the white stations, and the black kids generally would only listen to the black stations. So it was all separated. It was in the UK, it was a big melting pot, and that was so great for us, I think.
Well, you're right, because I grew up in New York City. I've told this story before. We had three stations on the AM dial that played rock and roll. And Murray the K, who you mentioned before, was the leading jock on one of those stations. Cousin Brucey was the leading jock on one of the other stations.
Yeah, I remember Cousin Brucey.
And what we could do is we just surfed from one station to the other, and we heard every one of those hits that was coming out of England for the most part. It was just a magnificent time. Hi, everybody. This is Robert Miller, your host. As a musician and composer, I've crossed multiple genres. My early work includes jazz rock instrumentals like Spring Dance. And ballads like Ma Petite Fleur. Later on, I segued into vocal songs like Redemption Road.
But I'll come back strong, trying to stay on Redemption Road. I try to rise, make you surprise Redemption Road.
And along the way, I added collaborations with world-class musicians like Jim Peterik, Elliot Randall, and Tony Carey on The Fall of Winter.
He said, stand tall to yourself, be true. Don't let the fall of winter get the best of you. Had a voice like a boat from the blue. Don't let the fall of winter make a fool of you. Don't let the fall of winter make a fool of you.
I also pride myself on the reimagined covers I've done, including The In Crowd.
I'm in with the in crowd. I go where the in crowd goes. I'm in with the in crowd. And I know what the in crowd knows. Yeah, yeah.
And then recently, I've come full circle with The Rich Ones, a jazz instrumental with guest artist Randy Brecker. For me, crossing genres helps keep the music fresh. Once again, I want to thank you all for listening to this podcast, and keep on rocking. All right, we're going to get backed up here if I don't get to that Songfest portion, because I want to play the hits that people know, and we're only going to play a little bit of them, but let's start with She's Not There. We talked about it earlier. You had that iconic beginning with the bass and the keyboard. And, you know, the whole modal thing that you didn't even know you were doing on top of, on top of the keyboard part.
Well, no one told me about her, the way she lied. Well, no one told me about her, how many people cried. But it's too late to say you're sorry, how would I know? Why should I care? Please don't bother trying to find her. She's not there. Well, let me tell you about the way she looked, the way she had said the color of her hair.
Tell me your recollections and feelings about that song all these years later.
Well, I always sort of say that I had the arrogance and naivety of youth that you only have once. And I thought when we were signed to Decca, it was on the back of winning a beat competition. And Dick Rowe from Decca, who turned down the Beatles, walked into our dressing room and said, I'd like you to record a single for Decca. And we said, yeah, great. And we got a producer that was a friend of a very good professional musician who was a friend of Chris's. But he said, I know a really good producer. He said, if I were you, I'd get him just to look over the Dick Rowe contract. So we said, yeah, okay. And then a few days later, he came back to us and said, I've seen the contract. He said, it's not bad at all, actually. It's really good. He said, there are one or two things I would change. He said, but do you know what? He said, I think you could have a producer rather than just go in there yourself and do it, you know. And he said, I would love to produce you. And he had produced a couple of hits. And we thought, yeah, okay. And he said, do you know what? You could always try and write something yourself. And the only two people who listened to that or heard that were Chris White and myself. And we went away and I wrote She's Not There. And it was only the second song we that I'd ever written. But with the arrogance and confidence of youth, I thought I could write something that's as, you know, I was thinking Beatles that time. They'd just come out. No, it wasn't. It was 2 years after they come out. And I thought I could write something as good as that. And Colin's going to sing it absolutely great. So we rehearse it. We were in the studio in 2 weeks' time. I said, we really, really rehearse it. But there was one program called Jukebox Jury on the television. And they played 2 minutes or a minute and a half or 2 minutes of each record. And they had a panel on there, different celebrities every week. Yeah. And to my horror, I found that the week they played She's Not There, which was a wonderful thing in itself, because I couldn't believe it had gone on to it. One of the guests was George Harrison. And the Beatles were gods at that time, absolute gods. You know, it was like word down from Mount Olympus, you know. And I thought, oh, my God, if he doesn't like the record, I'm going to give up. And there's no way I can ever record anything else. And I started watching the programme. And for about the first four records or five records, it wasn't nasty, but he was saying, no, I don't really reckon that. And I don't think really that's got much of a chance. No, 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 I don't think that's a hit. And then our record came up and I thought, oh, my God. And then he listened to it. And in the end, not only did he say, well done, Zombies, he said, that's really good. He said, and if that's their real keyboard player, that's great. And I thought, what? He just said that. That was George Harrison. You know, and I'm sure that gave us a kick, you know, that started it being a hit record. And we were managed so badly that after that, they put out completely the wrong record. They wanted it out 6 weeks later, the second record.
I can imagine. Well, before, I got to tell you this, the little vignette. I had Jeremy Clyde from Chad and Jeremy on the show, and he talked about how he was on Jukebox Jury, and they played a summer song, which was their massive, massive hit, right? And Ringo was one of the panelists, and apparently everybody gonged the song, okay? Everybody thought it was a miss, although Ringo did say maybe they'd like it in the States or something like that.
Well, there you go.
All right. I want to go to your next big hit, which was Tell Her No, another extraordinary song. And this one, I always thought that Colin's vocal was so different and unique in this song.
And if she should tell you, come closer. And if she tells you with a charm, tell her no, 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 no.
And what did you think about that?
Well, I was going to say flippantly that maybe it was different and unique because he fell asleep just before it was time to do his vocal. And when he sang on one of the lines, that goes da 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 da, he forgot the words. And he did his vocal and he came back in. And he said, oh, I've got to overdub that bit because I'm just going, love belongs to me, you know. And it's rubbish what he was singing. And the producer said, no, it's fine. Next track. Because that's how it was in those days. You know, there was just no sort of effort really went into really concentrating and maintaining your you know, the whole process. So that was funny, but that's just an aside, really.
I got to tell you, you just reminded me. Do you remember when Frank Sinatra did Strangers in the Night?
Okay. Yeah.
It was massive hit. And at the end, the last verse, he did this whole Scooby-Dooby-Doo thing,
which
was not supposed to be part of the song. And either he forgot the words or he just decided to do the whole Scooby-Dooby thing.
Yes, I know he didn't like to do many takes, did he, Sinatra? So if he felt that he'd done okay, then fix everything else, you know.
Well, it was kind of a light touch, if you will, on the vocal.
Yeah.
And I thought that just worked with Tell Her No. I really did. Okay, let's move to your other massive hit in the Zombies, which, of course, was Time of the Season.
It's the time of the season. Love runs high in this time, give it to me easy, and let me try with pleasured hands to take you in this time to promised lands, to show you everyone it's the time of the season for love.
There's a story behind that. I'm going to let you tell that story.
Well, the story of Time of Season, it was the last session we had for the album. And we were writing the songs as we went along. So the album was recorded over about, I don't know, 6 months or something, even though there was just basically one or at the very most two, three-hour sessions for each track. I remember I was sharing a flat with Chris White and his friend also at the same time, at that time. And I remember saying to Chris, he was in the next room, and I remember going to see him and saying, I've got a song, you know, it could be our last song. And I said, do you know what? I think it could be a hit. I was the only one that thought that. I mean, no one else thought it. They just thought it was the last track to do on the album. But we had Jeff Emmerich, who was recording that session, and he was a wonderfully intuitive sound guy, absolutely wonderful.
He was the Beatles guy, right?
Is the Beatles guy. And I remember going in there and we recorded what we'd rehearsed, because we rehearsed it over several days, and we recorded all that. But because the Beatles were the previous group in there to us, they caused some things to happen technically. And they caused it to be able to use more than four tracks, which was what everyone was using at the time. So we recorded as we had done before, everything on four tracks. And then we suddenly found we had three extra tracks, and because of what they made the technicians do there. And so it gave us a little bit of spontaneity. So we'd rehearsed very carefully because we had to. We didn't have much time. But always there was a little bit of time for intuition and momentary inspiration. So I remember Jeff Emmerich getting this fabulous sound on the toms and the bass on the boom, 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 doom, boom, 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 doom. And it was just a backbeat, simple backbeat at that time. Do, do, doom, boom, do, do, doom, boom. And we all thought it sounded great. But I said, we had half an hour left on the session. And I said to Hugh, our drummer, do you know what, Hugh? I said, I agree with you. I think it sounds great. And I love the sound of the toms and the bass together. It's just fabulous. I said, but I can hear a sort of just before the backbeat and just after the backbeat. So instead of do do do, I can hear do do do, you know, like that.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. How did that get in there?
Well, that was it. And I expected Hugh to go in and do it, but he said no. He said, you know, it's your idea. You go in and do it. I said, you sure? And he said, yeah. And like a lot of the things that were the momentary inspiration on that album, it was just one take. We had half an hour left. I went, and Jeff, bless him, Jeff Emery, got a fabulous sound on claps. I could never repeat that. I've tried so many times to repeat that sound. And it took him about 10 minutes to do it. But he got it, you know, and then it came out. Eventually it came out because it was turned down by CBS in the States. Clive Davis was their new MD there, and Al Cooper had just joined as the hot producer at the time. He came over to the UK, he picked up 200 albums, and he went back to Clive Davis and he said, I've picked up 200 albums, but there's just one that you have to buy. And I don't care how much it costs. You've got to buy that album. And Clive Davis said, well, we actually have it. He said, but I've turned it down because I don't think it's really commercial. And Al Cooper said, you have to release it. And he was the new big star there. So Clive said, okay, we'll give it a shot. So they put it out, and they put Butcher's Tale, which I think is a brilliant Chris White song, but not a single in a million years, and put that out, and then put something else out. And then he said to Al, well, we've given it a shot. Nothing's happening. And Al Cooper said, you've got to give me my choice of single. My one choice of single is Time of the Season. And Clive Davis said, are you sure? He said, yep. So he put it out. Nothing happened at first. And then one DJ in Boise, Idaho, started playing it. And like a stone being thrown into a pond, the ripples went out. And gradually, people from further away started playing it. And then it caught fire.
No, I have to stop you for a second, because I have heard that same story over and over and over again, how a record was picked up by a random DJ somewhere, you know, in a place that you didn't think about. And either they turned it over where they played the B-side because they liked it better than the A-side, or they just got behind it. And it spread like a pebble in the ocean from there.
Absolutely. And it's so great that that could happen then. It very rarely happens now, because records seem to have a 2 or 3 week slot, you know.
Plus the radio stations, first of all, nobody listens to radio anymore the way that they used to.
Yeah.
And also everything is with the gatekeepers, and, you know, the music is all programmed. It's not up to the jocks any longer what they play. So that's an era that you were part of and you were fortunate to be part of that just doesn't exist any longer.
It's crazy that it doesn't. But, you know, I quite understand how the business people always take over. But I remember there was another time when FM first started. And when the DJs started broadcasting in FM, and I remember hearing the Crosby, Stills and Nash album for the first time, because we were listening on the radio and the jocks were really enthusiastic. They really knew what they were playing and what they loved. And they played a Crosby, Stills and Nash track. And the guy afterwards, the DJ said, do you know what? He said, I'm going to play the whole album. So on the radio, he played the whole Crosby, Stills and Nash album, or at least the one with Our House on it. I think it was the first one. And he said, at the end of it, he said, do you know what? I love that so much, I'm going to play it again. So he played the album twice. And the extraordinary thing is that there's never been so much contact or enthusiasm from audiences when they weren't logged into a very strict business control playlist. But, you know, and that's such a pity.
It is, because back then, you're right, it was more organic between the audience and the disc jockey and the bands and the artists. It was a much different era. I was on college radio in the 1960s, and it was free form, like you're describing for the FM stations. We could play anything that we wanted. And if you had educated jockeys, they would get the audience into things that they didn't even know existed. Okay.
Absolutely.
Anyway, different era. All right. I want to move on. You formed Argent and you had that big, massive hit, Hold Your Head Up. Tell us about that one.
In those days, it was unhip to have singles. We went through a little period in the UK when it was unhip to have singles. So we were recording a new album, and as became the whole thing with us, we were going on tour and we hadn't anywhere near finished the album. So the record company said, we have to put something out. We're going to put out an EP. So they put three tracks out. They put the long version of Hold Your Head Up on there, which was about, I think it was about nearly 6 minutes long or something like that, with a 3-minute organ solo in it. And it came out, and of course radio didn't play it except for one DJ called Alan Freeman. And he had a show on BBC every week on a Saturday, and he played it every single week for about 3 weeks, and it wouldn't go away. It was nibbling underneath the 50, you know, in the UK, but quite a bit under the 50, maybe 70 or something like that. And then we went to Holland as part of our tour. While we were away, we got a phone call from CBS saying, "We've edited your record and we put it out as a single." And we thought, no, it's not hip to have a single. We don't want it out. But what they did was cut out the 3-minute organ solo, and the thing became a huge hit. But that's how it came about, really.
That happened a lot back in the day. They would take, you know, whatever the records were, and they would chop them into kind of radio friendly.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of a couple of things that happened to. If you remember the song Inagata De Vida.
Yeah, okay? Yeah, absolutely.
It had like a 50-minute organ solo.
They
chopped it down to, you know, like 2 or 3 minutes, and that worked. You know, that became the hit, right? And the Doors had something like that too. I think Light My Fire had a very long solo section on the album. They cut it down for the radio, and that's what you hear, of course, for the last 50 years.
But the one thing that I loved was the fact that after our record became a hit, Hold Your Head Up, it became hip again to some degree for bands like Led Zeppelin or whatever to dare to release singles again. So I was really pleased in the end that happened.
You were a leader, huh? I loved that. All right. So you got this brand new album coming out, you and Colin and the new Zombies. And we're going to play little bits of two of the songs underneath my voice. Love You While I Can. And Dropped Reeling and Stupid. Tell me a little bit about this situation.
Well, I mean, I'm really knocked out in a way because we've gone back to what we did with Odyssey and Oracle. We've made a completely self-produced in-house album in my studio, and it's what we wanted it to sound like, basically. So, you know, with no reservations, basically, although some things can always be better, you know, but at the same time, we were knocked out to have it out. And the one thing that we've got a single that goes to radio proper coming out on the 31st of March, but the record company, who loved the whole album, wanted to put out 2 streamed teaser singles first, just on streaming. And the first thing that they put out was Drop Reeling and Stupid. And to our amazement, radio over here has started playing it to some degree. It's done 180,000 streams already. In just 2 or 3 weeks. And I'm not saying it's going to be a massive hit, but the interest in it is just huge. And it's made a couple of charts, not the national charts yet or whatever, but the reaction to the beginning of it is just so lovely. I'm so pleased.
Isn't that nice? You know, it's so hard to maintain a career over a long, long period of time. All you guys back in the 60s, I'm sure, you know, I had this discussion with John Lodge when I had him on the show. And he said when he was 19, his friends asked, what are you going to do when you're 21? Okay.
Yeah, because I know.
Everybody thought it was going to last for a couple of years at most. And I've heard the same thing from everybody. But here it is, you know, 50 or more years later, and your music still endures, and you have great fans, and I'm sure it's multi-generational as well. How does that feel?
It really is multi-generational. The thing that knocked me out when we started making headway again, you know, we've been back together since around the year 2000. But in the last 10 years or so, it's gone like that in the States particularly, absolutely like that. And when we first came over, capitalizing our own tours in this incarnation in the early 2000s, we played in Georgia. There were 12 people there. We play in Georgia now and we get 2,000. I mean, it's extraordinary, really. And it's just great because we've always embraced the idea of doing it because we want to keep creating and keep getting enthusiastic about creating new music. And we almost always get a young component in the audience, along with people who I'm very pleased to say have followed us all the way through. But we always get young indie groups come to see us. We get a good proportion of the audience, usually, especially in America, who are young, and you get a huge amount of energy back. And while the tedium of touring is still harder than it ever was, the actual hour and three quarters or whatever it is on stage is the most rejuvenating thing, because it's like being 18 again, and there's just as much energy going out and coming back.
That says it all right there. We have been speaking with Rod Argent, the great Rod Argent from the Zombies and from Argent. I love all the stories and the backstories that you've been telling. I love all your music. And I want to thank you so much for being on this podcast, Rod.
Well, thank you. And I'm going to go home and look out one of your albums.
There you go. And I'm going to play you now the song that we started out with in this episode. It's one of my new songs called Waiting For Me. I want to thank you all for listening. And we will see you in the next episode.
Thanks for listening to the Follow Your Dream podcast. Make sure to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast so you don't miss another inspiring episode. You can connect with Robert at robert@followyourdreampodcast.com. And you can hear more from his band at projectgrandslam.com and at thepgsstore.com. But I still couldn't see if you
but I still couldn't see if you're waiting for me. Waiting for me.